from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, welcome everyone. One of the hardest working gals in the TV reporting business is Diane Diamond, and she's in North Carolina. I wonder what you're doing there, Diane.
Oh, there's this little federal trial. There's this guy named John Edwards who's on trial, facing 30 years in prison.
Yeah, I hear the prosecution rested today.
Yeah, they did. And I have been here every single day. I'm covering for Newsweek magazine and their website, The Daily Beast. Posting nightly updates on what's been going on. It was pretty interesting today the way they ended it, because much of the day was two federal agents, FBI agents, putting into the record these forensic phone number logs that they had designed.
Right.
And a group of bills that the a rich donor of John Edwards had been paying for his mistress to be on the run and hiding from the media. So it was pretty, it was important stuff, but it was kind of boring stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, this is how they're going to end the case? Well, yeah. Let me tell you, how they ended the case was with the ABC News interview, the only interview John Edwards ever did about this scandal, and they played all 20 minutes of it for the jury.
Right.
And it was stunning to go back and watch him in this 2008 interview. It really, in the only time his voice might be heard in that court, because I don't know if he's going to testify for himself or not, but the lies that rolled out of his mouth on that videotape were stunning.
What was his reaction, Diane?
You know, it's a small courtroom, and there are pillars and posts all over it. So sometimes I can get a really clear look of his face. It depends on where I'm sitting. Today, I couldn't see much except the side of his face.
Yeah.
He was looking at the monitor, at himself, but mostly he just looked down at the desk.
Yeah.
And that's unusual, because usually he's looking up, he's got his chin up, he looks optimistic, he's looking at the jury, but not this afternoon.
I wonder if he's checking his hair at the same time in the monitor.
You know, I noticed he had exactly the same haircut today as he did then. But, you know, in this interview, he said he'd had a quick affair with a woman in 2006.
Right.
It was all over. He told his wife about it. She knew everything about it.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was not the father of the baby. He didn't know that his friend Fred Barron, the Texas billionaire, was footing the bill for the mistress and the baby on, you know, as they were still traveling around the country. He had no idea about that.
You know, there's a...
And I thought to myself, you know, you have no idea what your pregnant mistress, your baby mama, what's she doing? You know she's unemployed. You know she has a mountain of debt. And while you're not admitting that you're the father here, you know you are.
Yeah.
And you're saying you have no idea how she's surviving or living? Oh, it just, I don't know, it was creepy to go back and watch it today. That was a good way to end the case.
Yeah, for sure. Diane Diamond's here. She's covering the Edwards trial for Newsweek magazine and The Daily Beast. The sleaze factor in this case is goes right back to the early National Enquirer stories, to a guy that has aspirations of being on the Supreme Court, to vice president, to president.
Attorney general, nation's top cop.
Oh, yeah. is he as much of a nut as we're all starting to think he really is?
Well, you know, his former press secretary was here yesterday. Jennifer Palmieri is her name. She works in the White House now for President Obama in
right.
the communications department. She used the word deluded. He was deluded.
Yeah, that's
and
a good one, yeah.
Somebody had to tell him. She said, finally, I told him, you ain't never going to be the attorney general, and you're never going to be the vice president, and somebody needs to tell you, and I just did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think... You know, there's been a lot of sleaze stuff here, you know, from the mentions of the sex tape, that he apparently made with the mistress to what his wife didn't know, and to Elizabeth's angst, so upset that one day she just screamed in front of all of their staff on an airport tarmac, "You don't see me anymore!" And she ripped off her blouse.
Ooh.
Ripped off her bra.
Yeah.
This is a breast cancer survivor.
Sure.
And said, "Look at me." You know, it just, it's been a very emotional trial. I think a very emotional trial. Today, another witness came. His name was Leo Hendry, and very successful businessman. He started the Yes Network, the Yankee television network in New York.
Sure.
And he told a story about how everyone's forgotten about Andrew Young, the one who wrote this book and falsely claimed paternity. And he said, you know, in 2009, he came to see me in my office in New York, and he said he was as sad a man as I have ever seen. He thought his future was gone. He had no way to support himself, and he wanted advice on whether or not he should do a tell-all book. And just the way he painted this defeated former senatorial aide who had been riding so high as the right-hand man of John Edwards, I just started to think how many lives have been impacted by John Edwards' bad decisions.
It's interesting to watch the trial now that the prosecution has rested and the defense will last, you know, however long that case will be. But right in the middle of the election that's going on right now, the election process and the public confidence in the government, is this going to have that much effect on it, Diane? Here you got this, you know, former presidential candidate, and you got to wonder what the people are thinking. Are all our candidates as goofy as this guy?
You know, that is such a good question, because I think they might think that.
Yeah.
No, but I also think it could have an impact on the jury verdict. You know, everybody brings their own baggage to every situation and their own experiences, and it's no secret in America that the United States Congress, for example, only has a 13% approval rate.
Jeez.
Everybody's mad at the politicians. You're bailing out the banks. I'm losing my house. You're bailing out the auto industry. I can't buy a car. You know, there's such a seething anger underlying emotional passion against politicians. I just wonder if this jury is going to remember all the bad stuff and not hear any of the defense case that's about to come up. It could have an impact, I think.
It is interesting. Diane Diamond's here covering the John Edwards case. Blagojevich in Illinois. Different case, obviously, but again, the confidence of the people in their elective representatives. What about how it's been covered? This story, with everything else going on, the gay marriage and all that sort of stuff going on now, it seems to have, you know, fallen a couple of places. But once this hits the jury and they come back and there's a decision, I think all hell's going to break loose.
Well, I'll tell you, here in North Carolina, they've been distracted by a same-sex marriage amendment on the ballot yesterday.
Right.
It went down. It was not approved. And anyway, so there has been a bit of a shift of focus recently because of that here. But I found a vast amount of interest every time I post something on thedailybeast.com. You know, my editor tonight was like, "Hurry, hurry, we got to get the story up there. You know, the prosecution is rested." So I don't know if the rest of the news cycle is just slow now or what, but every day I go into that court and there are more and more members of the public who want to get in, who want to see this, who want to understand what's happening. And unlike Blagojevich, you bring up a good point. This is an unprecedented federal prosecution in that Blagojevich was trading things for his own gain.
Right.
There was money going into his pocket, so to speak. Edwards was smart enough, if he is guilty, and I'm not saying he is or not, but there was no money went into his pocket. There was no, you know, new Cadillac sitting in his driveway all of a sudden, or money that went into his campaign fund. It was supporters on the side who had already given all the money they could, giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to support a mistress as what?
Yeah.
As a favor? So to keep the information away from Elizabeth, as the defense says? Well, Elizabeth already knew about the affair and the baby.
Yeah.
So what's left is, was he using that money to try to salvage his campaign? And if that's what the jury decides, then he's guilty.
Yeah. And he's in a lot of trouble.
Riel, 30 years, yeah.
Riel Hunter on the prosecution list, not called. Will we see her as a defense witness?
You know, I'm not convinced we will.
Yeah.
I know everybody's been screaming about, oh, Riel's going to come, she's going to come. I, you know, why bring the crazy person to the circus is what I say. There's been so much negative said here,
yeah,
about her and her, you know, her need for astrology and her, she has to feel the karma in the room and mm-hmm. she wears dark glasses at night and scarves around her head. And, you know, I'm
Jeez.
Just, and she thinks that the baby they had was some sort of divine gift from God and is going to save the world.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I don't know. Is that the kind of person you bring in to defend John Edwards?
Well,
I don't think so.
No.
I would not be surprised if we don't see her here at all.
Yeah, I agree. How about you, Diane Diamond? The prosecution has rested. Have you rested?
Mm-mm. Not a bit. I just poured my second Diet Coke.
Yeah.
And I'm busy now writing a little piece for Newsweek magazine for next week. So,
is this
you know, I live for this stuff.
I know
you
know
that.
Yeah.
I love to be in a courtroom. I always say it's sort of like courthouses are like this cauldron of human soup. You know, it's old and young and black and white and Asian and Hispanic. And, you know, whoever walks in the door, you get the same kind of justice, whether you like it or not. It's the way our system works. And I'm always fascinated by it. This is really a good case to cover.
Will this, and this is a little out of your realm, but will this hurt the Democrats in this election?
Oh, you know, I think it might hurt all politicians.
Yeah.
It's another smear on the political, that those who are attracted to run for politics in the political system. You know, I'm watching this jury in here, and I've seen a few of them. There's one that's a vice president of a corporation. One is a human relations department chief. One is a financial advisor. So they get the money thing. And there's been so much said here about John Edwards for president campaign and how much money it can take in. But then John Edwards sets up the Center for Promise and Opportunity. It's a 527 organization, which means it can take all the money it wants from anybody it wants. It never has to report a thing. And then he started another organization called College for Everyone. And that can get in all the donations it wants from any single, and it never has to report them. And then there was a third organization. And what is the purpose of all of these? To get John Edwards elected president. They'll tell you straight out. So why do we have rules and regulations if you can get around them and start a 527 nonprofit and just take all that money and run for president with it?
Yeah.
You know, it's. I think there's I see the jury coming to a realization of, wow, that's how it works?
That's
and I don't think they're very pleased with that.
Well, we can say one thing. John Edwards might be an intelligence guy, but he's certainly wasn't thinking with the right head. Diane Diamond, always a pleasure. I appreciate your time. I know how busy you are covering the story of the John Edwards trial for Newsweek magazine and the Daily Beast. Thank you, ma'am.
You know I'm always delighted to be with you.
Appreciate it.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Diane Diamond. Works for Newsweek, Entertainment Tonight. She's been on all the networks, and she's been covering these kind of trials for a long time. And John Edwards, again, thinking with the wrong head for sure. I'm Dana Pretzer. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with someone who hasn't been on the show for a while, Susan Murphy Milano, to talk about her new book, Holding My Hand Through Hell. And Susan, of course, is a domestic and a violence expert. And we're going to talk about the scourge of domestic violence and how it is either getting better or getting worse. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. All right, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. It's been a while. Susan, how are you?
I'm great, sir. Thank you for having me back. It has been a while.
Susan Murphy Milano, a friend of the show from a while back, a domestic violence expert, has a book coming out soon called Holding My Hand Through Hell. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm. It isn't. Now, Diane Fanning, who wrote Mommy's Little Girl, wrote the foreword for it, and I'm honored and flattered that authors like Greg Olson and so many other New York Times bestseller authors have endorsed the book and given reviews for it. And I kind of didn't expect it. When you do something like this, you don't expect it, and it's not anything anybody expects. It's about hope. It's about God. It's about holding your hand through hell. I mean, people don't see, we all come off really strong. You do, I do. Yeah. When tragedy strikes, then we put our faces forward. But through the eyes of a child, we don't know what happens really behind closed doors. And when you go to your pastor, you go to your principal, and you say things are going on and help me, and you're very young, you're 7, 8 years old, and nobody listens, then you're not believed. And so you're called a liar, you're called names, you get suspended. So I had a difficult time as a kid wondering, you know, why nobody believed me. Was it because my dad had a badge and a gun? So the battle was probably more difficult after my parents died in 89 than it was prior to that. At least I knew what to expect. And this road of trying to keep victims of intimate partner violence and homicide from being homicide victims has been, you know, interesting. It's been tough. It's not been easy. I mean, people don't realize. So people had been kind of, you know, bugging me to do a book, and I said, well, okay. And publisher picked it up. It's going to be out in the fall. I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, I know that sounds strange, Dana, but this is my life, as naked as you're going to get, but not in some, you know, battered woman kind of, you know, form. It's about a child and who grows up, and my hope is with my mom, and I realize that after she died that my hope is gone. Mm-hmm. I have no more light, and I don't really care about anything. And I think that that's what we don't see. You're seeing all these families across the country who children are witnessing the murders firsthand, very young, or who are left behind, and there's nobody who has talked through this battle zone and said, this is what we have to do, this is how we have to do it, what goes through the mind of a child. And my father had audio taped the murder of my mother, so in every single case that we see, Jackie Waller, who's been missing since June of 2011, that we're coming up on her first year anniversary, that she's been missing, you know, you got Susan Powell, you got Stacey Peterson, the list goes on and on and on. And we all want to know when they die or when they disappear, what happens behind closed doors. My father audio tapes the murder of my mother, and you can hear everything from the doorbell ringing to her coming in to her being thrashed about in the kitchen, screaming, coughing, choking for her life.
Yeah.
And he wants to watch her die. He wants, because he's controlled her life, so he wants to see that last breath. And even after he shoots her, he's still talking to her.
Yeah.
He's still saying, why are you looking at me? Because, you know, her eyes are still open. You put the towel over her face. I think it's just what, you know, behind closed doors. So the book is it's very different, I think.
Susan Murphy Milano's here. Just interrupt for 1 second, Susan. I've got some breaking news coming across the wire. For those of you following the story of Adam Mays, I'm getting a tip here that he has been found dead, yet the two girls are alive.
That's true.
Yeah. Have you heard that?
Yes, I have.
Okay,
The girls were taken to the emergency room. They are safe. They're alive. And he was shot dead by our sheriff.
Good. Or I shouldn't say that. I think you know where I'm coming. Susan Murphy Milano is here. And let's talk about this, Susan. Besides your book, that story, this story, all the stories that are out there, they seem to be a whirlwind of despair and violence and victims and you name it. I'm interviewing a Canadian talk show host here after you. Comparing the U.S. system to the Canadian system, and that term that I actually picked up from you a long time ago called re-victimization, where not only are you re-victimized, whether it's through the court process, you're re-victimized because your father tapes something, God only knows why, to hear it. You're re-victimized every time you talk about it. Is there anything we can do in either system, and our systems are pretty close together about that re-victimization, because all the stories you've covered, I've covered, there just seems to be that big aspect of it.
I think we need to stop, maybe we need to call them cases, and I think that stories signify something that really isn't true. Story. I think that maybe that's a wrong usage of a word to you know, label these, as people don't want to think that these are crimes, first and foremost.
Yeah.
Behind closed doors, and they're silent. I mean, we don't look at it as anything other than, you know, oh, they look like such a nice family. But Dana, at the end of the day, when we read about these or we speak to the families, what happens is that they say nice words about people who are no longer here, and nobody is willing to really understand or see these are crimes. And there's laws against them on the books, both for misdemeanors and for, you know, everything about pushing, assaulting, hurting. We don't look at that. We go, oh, you know what, she can get out. But she can't. What she does is she's in a relationship. She loves this guy. And if they have kids, it makes it worse. It's not like when, you know, we're younger and we're dating somebody. We don't talk to anybody about it because this person shows so much affection to us. And we don't think it's a situation where she can't get out of it. But she can't. Because what nobody sees are the threats and the intimidation. She knows that something's going to happen to she or and her children. And there's cases when women as well have taken the lives of men or their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't a gender-specific crime. But we don't look at them as crimes. And I hope in my lifetime, I've been doing this a long time,
mm-hmm.
that I can see a change. I mean, we just created a site called DocumentTheAbuse.com, the Evidentiary Abuse Affidavit, where, you know, it came out of the birth of Stacy Peterson going missing in October of 2007. I was in the church with Pastor Neil Shorey. That's who she saw weeks before she disappeared. And I said, why didn't you tape her? Because he had equipment that he would tape his sermons for. And he said, I didn't think about it. A year later, I came back, and I said, I can help remove Crawford versus Washington, which says, Dana, if you were to kill me or make me go missing,
yep.
then you have the right to face me, per the Sixth Amendment, the person that's accusing you of this crime. Well, that's what's happening. But now there's also what's called the forfeiture doctrine, which, you know, he forfeited her. He made her go missing. These guys are the last people to see this person, this mother, this lover. And in Peterson's case, he's the last one to see her. He's now up for trial. We're all waiting for the date for Kathleen Savio, his third wife, who was found at a dry bathtub on March 1st, 2004. You know, all of these cases, how are they getting away with it? It's the pattern of conduct. And it's interesting that what I realized in doing Holding My Hand Through Hell book was that my father's pattern of conduct and violence really stemmed and went back to when I was a kid. His behavior with other people, other things, he made people believe things that may or may not have been true. He wanted the world to see him as a certain way. In Peterson's case, he wanted people to see him in a certain way. Kathleen Savio didn't have a shot
right.
in hell, because when officers would arrive and she would call and say, he's hurting me, he's threatening me, they would come and they wouldn't do anything because that's their sergeant.
Yep.
So, but he had already 2 years before had set the stage to say that Kathleen was crazy. Just like he had done with wife number two, Vicki Connolly, when he tells Kathleen, whom he's dating at the time, she's a heroin addict. Well, Kathleen's not going to go talk to her. So do you see the specific distinction with how they do this? They make you see they are wonderful. And again, we don't have the adequate services across the country. You and I would not stay in a shelter. Those are for dogs.
Yeah.
We have to have something that works. The DocumentTheAbuse.com, which is an evidentiary abuse affidavit and video, and it's also in the Times Up book, that works. Everybody that's used it hasn't died so far.
Susan Murphy Milano is here, and we're talking about, we're catching up. How's that, Susan?
We're catching up.
We're catching up. And we did lots of shows a few years ago, and but you're doing your own thing now. You've got some radio shows. Let's talk about those.
I'm actually doing a television pilot called Behind Closed Doors with ABC. We're shooting a pilot in a couple of weeks. It's going to be a weekly show on these cases, because I also work on unsolved cases mm-hmm. for families. I also put them together, working with families and, you know, pattern of conduct, going backwards, timeline. it's a scent that you have that you can see. Kevin Sweat was charged with the murders of the Wilikia girls. Those two girls, Taylor Placker and Skylar Whitaker, gone down. I think between them they had 13 bullets apiece in Oklahoma. Unsolved murder, 2008. Profiles wrong. Everything you could think of. They were looking for an Indian in a Tahoe, tribal. It wasn't. His girlfriend, Ashley Taylor, was missing in July of 2011. That person is responsible then for both the girls in Wilikia. So in working with the family, going and putting the case together, there was enough there so that there was, with Fox News, that successfully everybody jumped up and down enough that there was an arrest made for Ashley's murder, and he finally confessed to that, but the two girls as well. And we think that there's other murders. There is a pattern of conduct. You see this every day with what you do.
Yeah.
You know, you see it when you're on the street and you're doing certain things. You know. And I think that social media has played an important role, but yet a detrimental role in a lot of these cases, because people form opinions. They don't know. You have to be very careful about what you say, about what you don't say. You know, everybody's a critic or an armchair detective. And it's difficult sometimes, the cases. It's difficult on crime scenes. It's difficult because there's all chiefs and no Indians sometimes, and they don't talk. Everybody comes in the crime scene. They do not have a meeting afterwards or get together in the morning for coffee and say, okay, what'd you get?
Right.
There's a disconnect there. And they're traumatized too. I mean, I'm sure you've seen it in your career. What you do,
you know, and what we do here on the radio, and what you do with your television and your radio work, again, the old saying, giving the voice to those that can't be heard. Let's focus on that a little bit, because we haven't talked about that for a while. Bringing those stories forward, covering them correctly, like you say, having the armchair quarterback is one thing, but like the Jack Webb used to say many years ago, bringing out just the facts, I think, is so important. What about the networks and all that? Is it time, I know my answer, to have a show like what you're looking at?
It's time to say that we have to address these, because it affects everybody.
Sure.
I think that we think that it only affects a certain segment of society, but when we turn around, simply somebody was just going through a divorce, ending the relationship. Gail McCaffrey still missing out of St. Charles, South Carolina. And the family had called me, and I was able to put on the brother-in-law 15 minutes on my radio show on Thursday's talk. And he had told me that, you know, they just don't want to believe that he was capable of it. And Robert McCaffrey was just named a suspect. Call these SOBs what they are.
Yeah.
They are stone cold targets, period. Stop, you know, sugarcoating them. Every one of them, what do? Dana, they get a lawyer within, 24 hours sometimes? Look at Sean Pinierce. Renee Pinierce has been gone since January of 2009. Just days before his trial, 6 days before his trial, he confesses. Now, he's a first responder. He's a fireman. And he says that she fell down the stairs. And then he put the body in the trash. Please. He murdered her. It was premeditated. If Renee had the opportunity to do the evidentiary abuse affidavit, we wouldn't be talking about it. They would be able to arrest him right away. That's what this does. So before you say that the relationship is over, before you announce it, go to documenttheabuse.com, look at the example of the evidentiary abuse affidavit. We give it to you. And look at the steps. Look at what you have to do. So that if something does happen to you, if you're not able to speak, he's arrested. And this goes such a long way. There's a law school in Florida that's just put it up in Brevard, Florida now. I mean, it's been a slow process, but nobody has died on my watch in all these years. It's not taken a lot of money. It's just taken, you know, a heart and a soul to move forward and to help people do what they have to do to get out of their own way and stay alive. And it's not easy, but it doesn't cost a lot of money. I've got a technology company, Whetstone Technologies. Hopefully, we're ready to go May 15th with the Apple app, which is Chapter 4 of the Time's Up book, which is the evidentiary abuse affidavit. We've been held up because of registration and a couple other things as far as putting that manual in with the video so that she can tape it, so that she can do her documentation so she can get a witness and notarized again if something happens. I don't know about you, but I'm tired of these mothers, these women
yep.
being murdered
yep.
over and over and over again. And
yep.
we can stop it. We can do things to stop the bloodshed. But we got to get out of our own way to do it. Look in the mirror if you're in an abusive relationship. Stop saying it can't happen to me. Well, Susan Powell thought that. Stacey Peterson thought that. Kelly Rothwell, who's been missing since March 12th of 2011, thought that. She was a police cadet. She confronted her boyfriend. She was ending the relationship. And when she ended the relationship, no one ever saw her again. You can't do that. And that's what's going on in this country. You need help. You have to do it correctly. You just can't arbitrarily say the relationship is over with because you may die.
Susan Murphy Milano's here. When you talk about that, and we talk about these cases, and we could spend the whole evening bringing up names of cases, both of us can, and that's the unfortunate part, because every time you look in a newspaper, turn on the radio, television, internet, whatever, there's a new case that's out there.
And it's unfortunate, Dana, that I know every single one of these dates by heart. Always have.
Yes.
Somebody's got to remember them.
Absolutely.
And that's a crime in and of itself for a lot of these families.
What about our politicians? We elect them. I just did a segment about John Edwards. The sleaze just drips off that case. When we elect politicians to be our representatives to protect us, the politicians, gay marriage and all that sort of stuff, that's interesting, and gas prices and all that sort of stuff. But when there are people dying, you got to wonder, are they doing as much as they can? There's a lot more that could be done.
John Edwards is a perfect example of ignorance in America, somebody who's greedy. His
yeah.
wife is on her deathbed, and he's running for the highest office in the land. He wants people to trust and vote him for him. You know, I don't know if that system works anymore. No, if the laws and people that govern our laws really care about the American people very much. I think they care about their own bottom line, their own pocketbook, which results in their own pension and medical services for themselves. You don't see them out there begging to get medical services, do you? You don't see them,
no.
their families wanting for anything, but yet the people that they serve are poor. They've lost their jobs. What are they doing about that? What are they doing to make everything safer other than in their pockets? Again, Edwards is a perfect example of that. And, you know, it's interesting, Dana, is that Elizabeth Edwards does an evidentiary abuse affidavit
mm-hmm.
before she dies. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, that says something. And here's this woman fighting battle cancer. She's at the end of her life with more dignity than he has, you know, on his cuticle.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So how tragic and sad. And is he going to get away with what he's done? I mean, it's a small price to pay.
Yeah.
But look what he did to his family.
Mm-hmm.
So we have these people in office who say that they don't care, and they don't, unless they're held to a higher standard.
Exactly.
We don't have time. We're too busy. Can social media do that? Maybe.
Yeah.
Can we all start to come together instead of coming apart, looking on the Kaylee Anthony case,
yep.
the world had opinions, didn't they?
Yep.
Well, why can't the world come together and really, it's not about fighting battles, it's about helping your neighbor, it's about paying attention. You know, we wouldn't see so much crime as we have. I'm, like I said earlier, I'm tired of picking up these families, these people, nobody will help them. And if I can do it at very little money, basically, then that means that no one's doing it right, in my opinion. I've been doing this all these years this way, and, you know, in lecturing and doing what I do across the country, conferences, law enforcement training, that's what sustains me, but that's it. So why do we look less at women's lives or family violence than we do anything else, or human trafficking? Or, you know, the sale of that. Goldman Sachs recently sold their interest in Backpage.com. They knew exactly what they were doing.
Sure they did.
Those girls are worth $250,000 a head, for God's sake. You know, people don't understand because they don't think it happens to them. But more and more, we're seeing more young girls being abducted off the street. They're being sold by their own parents. The last person that sees somebody that goes missing or it's abducted, whether it's a child or it's a grown-up, that person should be the one that is brought down and charged.
Yep.
They know something, but we don't do that. We don't have that kind of radar on those people because their rights mean more than those that have been victimized or abducted.
Susan Murphy Milano, we're down to about 7 minutes or so, and I'm going to throw this out to you. I do this with all authors. Yeah, you know my, you know my style. When the book comes out, when the Holding My Hand book comes out, and I'm walking through the bookstore and I pick it up and I take a look at it and maybe flip through a couple of pages or look at the back cover, what's going to make me want to take that book, buy it, and not put it down?
I hope that for the first time you're going to see the raw honesty of the book opens up with their crime scene. All the smells and touches and everything that happens. And it goes into the life of a family that could live right next door to you.
Right.
That you don't know what's going on. And it's kind of funny, I didn't know this, but a couple months ago they did the cover of the book. They have me as a child on the side, a little, and then me smiling nicely off of the cover. And I didn't know, and my people said, don't get upset, they put you on a cover. I said, well, yeah, that's a picture of me as a kid. Oh, no. I said, what did you do? So I'm all happy and smiling, and I said, what is this? Well, Holding My Hand Through Hell, this is the perfect picture to use. And I just done a photo shoot a couple weeks before that, and that's the picture that they want, and I said, okay. So it's showing that you can survive on the other side, that through all the darkness, that you have hope. In every one of these situations, these cases that we read and we see, that there is hope, that they can make it through. Yeah, it's hard. There's days you don't want to be here. There's days that it's tough. You lose everything because you don't know how to be. You didn't, and it's not an excuse, but it gives you an understanding of what a family faces, of what a victim faces, a mother faces, a child faces, of how the offender can be, how they're terrorized, how they can't move forward. And then it goes into my work with the women in some actual cases. You know, I'm very proud. Social media has brought back some women who are still alive 20 years later who got a hold of me, who I put a couple of them on some of my Thursday shows recently and were asked by my co-host Delilah, they said, what was it about Susan back then? And was she tough? And they said, oh, my God. But she would take a bullet for it. She would stand up in court. She would not move and waver. And we're alive because of it. And it's somebody has to stand up somewhere. And so I think that if people understand, you know, I could have written this years ago, I guess. But I didn't get out of my own way until probably a couple of years ago. That something had to knock me off my block hard enough to make me understand what hope is. And people say to me, now I look better or brighter. It's because I finally understood it. I could give it away on a street corner, Hope, but I didn't know what it was for me. And I think that that is, you know, we get to a certain point in our lives, it doesn't matter anymore. We don't worry about what somebody says, what they do. We just do the right thing and hope that we're crowned in heaven with the heaviest crown that there is, and I'm directing traffic when it's my time up there to say, okay, go over here. You go over here. That would be wonderful. And the people that have reviewed the book, again, like I said, Diane Fanning wrote the foreword for it,
sure,
which I'm honored that she did that, and so many other wonderful people gave amazing reviews that I never expected, and that when I was deciding whether I should do it or not, they were telling me reasons why I should. So we read about these news accounts and these stories, but now maybe you'll get a different insight into what really happens, because the children in these homes, in these beds, before they're killed, they wait for that moment for nights.
Yeah.
You know, my father as a child would threaten and say, I could burn the house down with you and the kids in it, Roberta. And I always thought my father would kill my mother first and then smother us and light the house on fire and go take off somewhere. He always said no one would ever believe anything that anybody said, or that they would believe that he wasn't capable of committing murder. You believe that. That is like a tattoo inside of you. So that becomes, you know, every sight, sound, and smell in your own home. You know, every crack and crevice. That's the way my life has been all this time. And you also realize, I hope, in the book, that it's not one generation or one life that it's affected. It's affected many. I don't have my son because of the work that I do. Because in court, he was younger, and I was costing the city a lot of money in lawsuits for wrongful death or these women being hurt, and I was being their voice and finding them lawyers. My son's father raised death certificates of my parents in the courtroom and said, well, Your Honor, her father killed her mother, and she's just as crazy. She's on television every week. She shouldn't have custody of her child, or that child is in harm's way. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
So now we have, you see cases where these mothers get their children taken away, or they wind up dead. They're erased from lives. So what do you do? And it's not something I ever really talked about, because it doesn't have a place. The gear shift I drive is keeping you alive.
Yep.
It's intimate partner violence, homicide, and stalking. That's what it is. It's picking up the pieces like Humpty Dumpty for these families and these kids who don't know how to go on, because nobody gives a hoot about them. And it's maybe people will see how prevalent this is. And I am lucky, yeah, I'm not in some institution somewhere, although I probably have checked in different times of the years, but I'm very fortunate to be as articulate, to be as of sound mind most of the time, to be able to do what I do. And this book has made me better. That sounds crazy, but it's made me more, I can walk on the ground, I can feel my feet.
There you go.
And I think that that's important. And again, it goes to hope. What the heck is hope? And when you never know what that is, it's an important light that you've got to have if you're going to sustain. What did Robert F. Kennedy's father say, Joe Kennedy, about, or no, Robert Kennedy said about getting old? It's a shipwreck.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure I'm staying afloat.
And you are. Susan Murphy Milano, let's stay in touch. And a little closer to the book coming out, we'll do this again.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Susan Murphy Milano. She's been there, done that. As far as a victim goes, you've heard the story. You could be able to read it in the Holding My Hand book. I sat down earlier today with Mike McIntyre and talked about some high-profile Canadian cases and a new project that he's involved in, and I want you to go and check that out tonight. You ever wanted to be on a jury, take a look at a case and give your opinion as to whether or not the person should be guilty or not guilty? Let's hear what Mike had to say. Everyone knows Mike McIntyre as a national radio show host. I'm reading this about Mike McIntyre. He's an author, a pundit, and a cruise director. We'll talk about that. Of course, he's been with the Winnipeg Free Press for, 1997. And, of course, his Crime and Punishment radio show runs on the Chorus and Ralco radio networks. Mike, welcome back.
Hey, good to be here.
You know, I'm flipping around the TV last night, and usually there's not a lot of good TV on, and I happen to come across Theo Fleury's little thing on HBO Canada. I don't know if you had a chance to see it last night or not.
I didn't. I've certainly read about it, and I guess it's sort of loosely based on his biography that he penned, although it doesn't sound like Fleury himself was involved directly with this project.
When you watch the HBO Canada segment, it basically follows him around. He takes him to Moose Jaw and Swift Current and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Very good. Recommend it. But what I thought was interesting was his discussion, and for anyone that watches it, if you're offended by foul language, you better put some cotton balls in your ears, because Theo is not one to hold back. His discussion about the justice system in Canada and comparing it to other countries, and of course sex offenders, and of course the whole Graham James things that you and I have talked about for some time. Lo and behold, I'm researching for the show today. I know I'm going to have you on, and I haven't looked at your webpage for a couple of weeks, and you are now involved in something called the verdict. And what a way to segue into the verdict about the justice system in Canada. Let the people decide, and that's what we're doing here at The Verdict. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was a pretty unique pitch that was made about a year ago through a company called Frantic Films here in Canada. I was brought on board as sort of a consultant, advisor, and ultimately a writer. And it was a very enticing type of proposal, one that I thought certainly made a lot of sense given the current climate in Canada with our justice system. As you know, Dana, there's probably nothing that gets people up in arms quite like our justice system. Maybe taxes would be up there as well, but people tend to get quite angry about the state of the justice system. And the common theme that I certainly get in terms of emails and phone calls, that sort of thing, is there's a real sense that people don't have any power, that we're powerless to really affect any kind of real substantive change. So what Verdict was and is it's fiction, of course, but we've taken the idea of what if we took the justice system as it currently exists and turned it on its head and made it sort of a hybrid of, you know, Law and Order meets American Idol, where judges would no longer wield the power to decide someone's fate. The traditional jury system that exists would no longer be sufficient, and that is where you get 12 people and they must all agree, all 12 of them, to reach a verdict. What if you turned the fate of an accused over to an entire nation, and basically the guilt or innocence of an individual was decided by popular vote based on a trial playing out in full public view with all the gadgets and gizmos that technology allows? So that's what Verdict is. That's the concept of it. And what we've done, starting about a month ago, we've launched a 15-episode series. It's all playing out online at verdictseries.com. And it's quite simple. Every Wednesday, you get to watch a new trial. The trials only last 5 minutes, so it's not a huge investment of time. And what you see in that 5 minutes is basically a synopsis of the prosecutor's argument and the defense lawyer's argument about a specific case. You can then, and you see flashbacks of key testimony and key evidence. There's also a supporting element online at verdictseries.com. You can actually view some of the additional evidence. And then you cast your vote. And 1 week later, when all the votes have been cast, the verdict is revealed, and we do it in a dramatic way. You get to actually see the reading of the verdict. We have a host, a la Ryan Seacrest, mm-hmm. who kind of, although female Ryan Seacrest, she ties the shows together. She renders the verdict, reads the verdict. You get to see the reaction. Then a new trial launches. So we're 5 weeks into our 15-week season, and we've tried to tackle some cases that are certainly controversial and hot-button-type topics, and ones that hopefully challenge viewers to dig deep down inside and come up with a verdict.
Yeah, I just looked at this week's and voted my either guilty or not guilty verdict, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But it's a fantastic idea, and it's something that you've been doing on your show somewhat, going through cases and calling out to the people and letting the people decide. And like the Fleury story last night, it's time that maybe Canada look at maybe getting the people involved more, because Theron Fleury wasn't too happy with the politicians last night, and I got this feeling that Joe and Mary Sixpack aren't too happy with the politicians either.
Yeah, well, I think that certainly the concept that we throw out there in Verdict, I'm not going to hold my breath and suggest that we're going to see that come to fruition anytime soon, but I think there's elements of it that certainly one might want to explore. For instance, the addition of cameras in the courtroom and the posting of evidence online, a more transparent, a more thorough type of justice system. I think one of the things you often hear from people these days is that it feels like the justice system it's sort of an exclusive club, and a lot of what goes on is done in secret, that the public really has no say in it. So I think we've, you know, taken, like I said, some of those bells and whistles that exist to broadcast, say, a trial, to bring the case into your living room. Not everybody can go down to court and sit in on a trial. And, you know, I think certainly there were some fears when we started this project that some people who reacted to it said, oh, you know, you're going to get lynch mobs, and why don't we just sort of burn people at the stake? And there was a sense that the vigilantes sort of element was going to take over. But we've actually seen 5 weeks into the series that there's a lot of common sense out there, and I think maybe we don't give the public enough credit, because we might, you know, you listen to that sort of very vocal minority sometimes and assume they speak for everybody. I think what we're seeing in verdict is that if you give people a lot of information, that people are very much capable of making an unbiased decision, a sound, rational, based on law type of decision, and that it's not just going to be sort of a mob mentality. You may have some of that, but I think at the end of the day, common sense does prevail, and the overwhelming majority of people will want to make a decision that is based on the facts as presented.
You know, preventing... or not preventing is not the word I'm looking for, but protecting the victim and trying to prevent re-victimization is always important from a prosecutorial stance. But we all know that the victim has to get up on the stand and again, use that term, be re-victimized, talk about Graham James, talk about other cases. Where do you look at as far as verdict goes, as far as getting the people to realize the process itself, and sometimes the victims are the ones that are put on trial?
Sure, and that's always been a concern, that it seems like the accused have far more rights than victims do, that, you know, during any trial, there's all kinds of things that you can't bring up about an offender's background. We've seen that play out in a lot of times in sex assault cases. For instance, a Winnipeg police officer just recently had a jury trial, a former Winnipeg police officer had a jury trial in Winnipeg where he was charged with numerous sex-related offenses. But what he did is he severed the cases into two trials. He had one single solitary charge go before a jury. He had the other 20 or so charges held back so that he could go by judge alone on those charges. Well, not surprisingly, the jury that heard just the evidence of that one single case in a legal vacuum, they acquitted him, because the evidence, it was sort of a he said, she said type of situation. And then what happens days later, he pleads guilty to nearly a dozen of the other remaining sex-related charges, which are much less serious than the one that he was acquitted of. So there's another example, and a lot of people quite upset by that, that why is it that he almost gets to pick, you know, what the jury hears about his background? And of course, we see it all the time in sex assault cases. Theo Fleury, for instance, the choices and the decisions made by victims are often put under a microscope. I mean, Theo Fleury was criticized plenty in court about why he waited to come forward, why he didn't disclose right away, the kind of scrutiny that it seems like offenders never get put on, and that's, I think, a big part of the frustration.
Absolutely. Mike McIntyre is here. Listen to his radio show, Crime and Punishment, Sunday nights on Chorus and Rocco Radio Networks. One thing in Canada we don't see is a lot of publicity for high-profile cases. We've talked about Graham James, but another case that's going on right now is the story of poor Tori Stafford, 8 years old, and Michael Rafferty. We're recording this May 10th, and it's going to go to the jury if it hasn't already. Let's get an update on what's been going on there.
Yeah, this is a horrible case, the kind of case that makes your skin crawl, and I guess, fortunately, these types of offenses are fairly rare in Canada, but this was the killing, the sexual abuse, the torture, really, and the kidnapping of an innocent little girl named Tori Stafford. It happened in Ontario back in 2009. She was abducted outside of her school about 103 in fact, days after she went missing. Her body was found buried under a rock pile in a forest, and two individuals got charged, a man and a woman. The woman pleaded guilty. Her name is Terry Lynn McClintock. She pleaded guilty to Tori's murder and is serving a life sentence. but she was a key witness against the remaining accused, her ex-boyfriend, Michael Rafferty. He's accused of doing the bulk of the damage against little Tori Stafford, specifically raping her and ultimately killing her by smashing her with a hammer. But what the jury is going to have to decide is basically this woman, who again is an admitted murderer because she's pled guilty, she's given two different versions of events. She initially put it all on her and claimed that she did the bulk of the damage to Tori and that Michael Rafferty was really not involved much at all. She then changed that story and, you know, put it all on him essentially. The jury's been left with these two versions of events. They have to decide which one they believe. Now, Michael Rafferty, even if the jury believes that he only played a minor role in all this, could still be convicted based on sort of aiding or abetting the crime. Dana, my prediction, I'd be shocked if the jury takes a whole heck of a lot of time with this. This was an abhorrent act, a horrible death of an innocent little girl, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that both of these individuals, in my opinion, were very much involved.
One last question for you. The PCs, the Progressive Conservatives, for those of you not in Canada listening, they're tough on crime bills, the firearms registry, and that's all muddled up again. You name it, the surge of the NDP and what they're trying to say and what they're trying to do. And, of course, they all like to blame each other. But let's take this back. 2 years ago, I'm interviewing Mike McIntyre, and I was to ask you, in 2 years, Mike, where will we be in Canada as far as crime and punishment? Excuse the pun, taking from your show. Are we any better or are we any further behind?
Well, we've seen moderate changes. We've seen some new mandatory minimums brought in, which are being utilized in certain situations, Dana. But, you know, it just strikes me that in a lot of, we're sort of like the gang that couldn't shoot straight in a lot of ways. I think in a lot of what's being done, it's missing the target. We're still not putting, in my opinion, the emphasis and the weight that we need on certain types of crimes. For instance, crimes where people lose their lives, impaired driving caused death, which remains a huge blight on society. Child pornography and child sexual abuse, I think, still sorely lacking in the types of real meaningful consequences to offenders. And, you know, it really strikes me the differences in how we treat, say, those horrible crimes against children and innocents versus how we treat things like weapon crimes in this country. I just recently covered a case where a guy who was moving from Ontario to British Columbia, passing through Winnipeg on a Greyhound bus, and stopped in Winnipeg, met some people. He gets hooked on cocaine. Long story short, he goes and commits a bunch of armed robberies. Nobody gets hurt except himself, because he actually, in one case, shot himself in the groin while fleeing a 7-Eleven robbery. Certainly there was an implied threat, and I'm not minimizing at all what the guy did, but he was doing it out of desperation to feed a drug addiction. And again, the only person that gets hurt is himself. He got 12 years in prison for a spree of robberies. And while I'm not saying that a guy like that shouldn't get 12 years, you know, he gets more time than a lot of people who take a life would get, and certainly more time. I mean, in some cases, double, triple, quadruple the time that we'd give to a child sexual offender who ruins the lives of his victims. And, you know, it just seems to me that a lot of what goes on in this country and in our courts is just really backwards. We're not putting the priorities and the emphasis where it really ought to be, and that's on the most vulnerable of society who are victimized.
Well said. Mike's webpage, mikeoncrime.com. Check out the verdict. It's awesome. I've done it, and I'll be watching it every week. Always
yeah,
a pleasure.
Verdictseries.com. Tell your friends, spread the word, and vote often.
Verdictseries.com. Always a pleasure, my friend. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Dana. Take care.
Bye-bye. And that's Mike McIntyre, radio host, author, and now part of verdictseries.com. Go try it out. It's only 5 minutes. It's actually a lot of fun to get in and get your opinion of the evidence that you're seeing. That's it. That's tonight's show. I want to thank all my guests. I want to thank all you listeners, whether you're listening live, watching on Channel 7, or picking up the podcast after. We wouldn't have much of a show without you. We'll see you again next week here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.